from our look at the parable last time, we had noticed that this was a parable of forgiveness, of grace, mercy, redemption, restoration, joy. It was a picture of a sinner, a rebellious one at that, and a picture of confession and also of repentance. We had also talked briefly about the reason that Jesus talked in parables, that he spoke in parables, was to reveal and conceal. And to those who have been granted to hear, see, and understand spiritual truths, they would react differently from those who have not been granted the ability to hear, see, and understand spiritual truths. So, if we try to place ourselves in the hearer's shoes, the parable can be very instructive for us, and this is what we are going to attempt to do today. Now, full disclosure, I am not an expert on Middle Eastern culture, and so much of what I am going to share with you comes from John MacArthur, also comes from Dr. Kenneth Bailey. Kenneth Bailey spent a number of years in the Middle East as a missionary, and actually John MacArthur borrows a little bit from Kenneth Bailey as well. So I'm just going to share with you what I learned from them. So to understand how a Middle Eastern agrarian peasant culture would respond to this parable, we're going to look at that. We're going to look at this parable a second time. Only this time we're going to bring in the culture, most notably the honor-shame system. We are so far removed from this concept of honor and shame, but it is very much ingrained in their daily life, and still is today. Now, for the most part, you did whatever you could to maintain your honor. Otherwise, you expose yourself to possible public shame, whether it's verbal or even physical shaming. And then you mix in the legalistic mentality of the Pharisaical system, and this concept of honor-shame becomes even greater, to where they are the ones that define what shame is and what honor is. A righteous person would uphold their honor, and thus the Pharisees portrayed themselves as ones not only worthy of honor, but also very righteous. And the Pharisees would be highly sensitive to this honor-shame system, this culture, and this parable in particular would greatly challenge them. Now, one thing I want you to think about as we go through this parable is the meaning of the word prodigal. Do you see the word prodigal in the parable at all?
No.
No, it's not in the parable at all, but we tend to call this the parable of the prodigal son. Now, the meaning of that word means spending money or resources freely and recklessly or wastefully extravagant. And so as we look at this parable through Middle Eastern eyes, if we can, I want you to think about who is the prodigal, really? Who is the one that is the prodigal? And would you title this parable differently? So let's look at our text today. Someone could read Luke chapter 15, verses 11 through 32 for me.
And he said, there was a man who had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of property that is coming to me. And he divided the property between them. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had and took a journey into a far country, and there he squandered his property in reckless living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in that country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into the fields to feed pigs. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, how many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread, but I perish here with hunger? I will arise and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants. And he arose and came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion, and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, Bring quickly the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet, and bring the fattened calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And they began to celebrate. Now his older brother was in the field, and as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing. And he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said to him, Your brother has come, and your father has killed the fattened calf, because he has received him back safe and sound. But he was angry and refused to go in. His father came out and entreated him. But he answered his father, Look, these many years I have served you, and I have never disobeyed your command. Yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours comes, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed a fattened calf for him. And he said to him, Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It is fitting to celebrate and be glad, for this your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found.
Okay, thank you, Steve. So let's go through this verse by verse, kind of like what we did last time. And I may bring up the same details that I did last time, so bear with me there, but also going to bring in some new details. So, starting with verse 11, as he said, a man had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of the estate that falls to me. So he divided his wealth between them. And as we had talked about before, just there in verse 11, we're introduced to the three main characters of the parable. A man who had two sons. So there's three people. And we noted that this younger son, he makes a demand of his father to give him his share of the estate. And we had talked about the word he uses. He uses the word estate or oesius. I'm probably not pronouncing that right. Instead of inheritance, which is kleronomia. And accepting the inheritance is accepting all the responsibilities behind that. You had to uphold the family name. You had to care for and seek ways to build the family estate for the family in the future. That was what you would be accepting if you wanted the inheritance, but that is not what he wants. He wants the estate. He didn't want the accountability. He wanted out, and he wanted the stuff so he could get there, so he could get out. This would have been, as we mentioned last time, to wishing that his father was dead, to remove the one and only obstacle for him to go out and do what he wants to do. This was his means to get out and away from the family. And what we didn't talk about last time was how the culture would respond to this request. To make such a request was absolutely shameful. This is out of line. This is disrespectful. And the normal way things worked was that nothing was distributed until the father died. Now, he could divide it and say, you know, this part, son, is yours, and this part is yours. He could initiate that. But never was the son supposed to make this request, let alone a demand. The father was in charge of the entire estate until his death. Now, what they would expect the father to do in this point is to become furious and slap the younger son for this request. He had to do that in order to uphold his honor. His honor was coming into question here. It's essentially, I work hard, I do all these things for you and the family, and this is how you treat me. So they may have also expected that there would be some public shaming with the village as well. Again, this whole honor-shame system was very important to them. And they would have expected that the father would do such things to uphold his honor from this shameful son. They may have also expected that this father would hold a public funeral of his son, an extreme form of public shaming where the father upholds his honor by proclaiming that this son is now dead to me. He's dismissed from the family. He's no longer part of this family. He is dead to the family. And we kind of see that later on, don't we? How does the father talk about his younger son later? He was once what?
Lost.
Dead. And now he's alive. So they would have also understood that if the father were to ever receive the son back, there would have to be restitution. The son would have to earn his way back into the family after everything was repaid. So something else that they would also expect that is not apparent in the text is they would expect that the older son would interject. While the father had the highest authority, the older son was second in command. He was to uphold his father's honor, even if it meant putting his younger brother in line. He was expected to act as a mediator in cases like this to maintain the family relationships. Relationships in Middle Eastern culture were supreme. They were very important. You would be willing to do anything for the sake of the relationship. And the relationship with a father is the highest form of relationship. And so for his sake, for the father's sake, the older son was duty-bound to do everything and anything he could to uphold his father's honor. But the older son is where? Where is he? He's most likely out in the field working, but he's missing. He's not here. So what could this indicate about him? What do you think?
He didn't care about his father.
Yeah, it seems apparent that he doesn't care about his father's honor, and he certainly doesn't care about his younger brother. Yes, Tom?
Well, I don't want to get off the track a little bit, but this is not a story about Jewish society. This is a story about God.
It is.
So therefore, anything, any bad habits that the Jew may have, God doesn't have. And with the way the father acted is perfectly consistent with God. He doesn't hold a grudge.
And we'll talk about that some more. But this has also been said in a culture, an ancient Jewish culture. So we have to understand that as well. That is the historical context. Yes, Rick.
We got to remember when we look at the parables that most of the time the intent is to drag the hearer into the story intellectually, but also emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
And so to understand the intended effect, we have to understand how the hearers would have heard this, and the hearers would have been very much emotionally charged over this. I mean, this is so counter to their culture. This is a shocking story.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just a story with a minor illustration. It is a story that is contrary to everything they hold dear with regard to social and personal relationships and conduct. And I mean, it depends a little bit on the era. This could have carried a death penalty, depending upon the era.
This is a shameful son.
But you may be going to say this, I was kind of waiting and listening, but you could say, I think without stretching at all, that in effect, this son that wants the funds, the younger son, is looking at his dad and saying, you're taking too long to die. I wish you were dead. Give me the money now. I'm tired of waiting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's exactly what's going on here. He is an obstacle to being able to get what he wants and do what he wants. What are you going to say, Melissa?
So the older son, should we assume that he doesn't care, or would it be something that he would have
He should have been concerned. There could be that, but he should have been concerned about what's going on here. And we'll see later on, his response in particular is what has been in his heart the whole time. So we'll look at that here in a little bit. So the older son not being there As I will mention, we'll see later in the story where his heart was the whole time. There's really two sons here that do not have a relationship with their father. They just don't.
Hey, I got it. You know, when you read it, it says he's out in the field doing the work and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
and that he hears, you know, like, sounds like rejoicing and laughter and gatherings and stuff, and he hears it. In my mind, I'm thinking he's out in the field working, possibly doing the things that need to be done, that had his brother been there, that they would have both been doing those, the chores and the labor and stuff, but he's fulfilling that, you know, and I don't know, maybe the servants were working and he was just out there watching, but had he been there, then they both would have been laboring together. So therefore, maybe there forms some resentment with that, you know, my brother has taken off, and here I have all the responsibilities, and he's not, I'm thinking a little bit, you know.
Well, I think when we get there, you're going to see that the resentment has been there way before the younger son left. We're going to see that, if we get there. It may not. I have several pages of notes here, so we may not make it there today. So there are two sons that want what is coming to them, really, and they just have two different ways of going about doing it. One wants his father dead now, he wants his inheritance or his estate now, he wants his stuff now. The older son is willing to wait for his father to die. So that is really what we're looking at. So you have this request, this shameful, disrespectful, out-of-line request, this demand from the younger son, and we had just talked about what the culture would expect his father to do to uphold his honor. But what the father does is countercultural, isn't it? What does he do?
He gives it to him.
He gives it to him. Instead of upholding his honor, the father graciously grants the son his request. There is no law that forbade this decision, but clearly the father was willing to take the rejection and the shame, as well as the economic loss. We're talking about one-third of the estate here. Now, how do you think the Pharisees and scribes listening to this parable would react so far in this story?
They would probably say, you should have given it to us instead.
But they might have said that.
I can't believe you did that.
Yeah, this is crazy. This younger son is stupid, and he's willing to really, I mean, in essence, commit suicide by this demand, this request. And I can't believe this younger son is doing this, let alone this father. What do you think the Pharisees would think of this father?
He should have beat his son half to death.
He should have.
He's making damages.
He's foolish.
It damages their whole plan if another person who's associated with them goes off and does something different. Takes away maybe what they think is their strength.
Mm-hmm.
What better picture of salvation by grace through faith than what the Father did?
Yeah, and we're going to see as we continue through this, they do not understand grace. Grace is offensive to them. And so the very fact that what this Father is doing would have offended them. They just don't understand grace. This Father is stupid, and he's also weak. He's not willing to uphold his honor. He's just doing what this younger son is asking.
So, Dad?
Yes.
And at the end of verse 12, it says, so he divided to them.
Yes, good, get to that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, verse 13. I'll get to that here in a little bit.
Okay.
So, let's go to verse 13. And not many days later, the younger son gathered everything together and went on a journey into a distant country, and there he squandered his estate with loose living. So, as Rick mentioned last time, while the estate was divided among the two brothers, one-third to the younger, two-thirds to the older, you technically could not possess the property until the father died. However, you could sell the property to a willing buyer, who would then take possession when the father died. So this assumes that the value of the property would go up in the future. So in order to sell it now, this younger son would have to do what?
Just take it or loss.
He'd have to take a loss. He'd have to sell this at a discount. This is what our futures commodities is all about. This is what's going on here. So the younger son sold his share of the estate, and to have one third of the estate out of the family now is a huge loss. But this son seems indifferent to these ramifications. The other two thirds of the estate now belongs to the older son. And it seems like, for the moment, he's willing to keep it within the family, care for it, build up the interest, the dividends in that. Now, as we see in a little bit, this younger son, we have made a note last time that he went to a distant country to increase the distance between him and his father. It's a picture of what is in his heart. And as we see, this is a country that is in Gentile country. So this would have been also offensive to the Pharisees. They couldn't fathom this Jewish boy going over into Gentile country. But when he is over in Gentile country, no one will know him. No one will care what he does. This is a perfect opportunity for him to be anonymous in whatever activities he chooses to do. And he throws his money to the wind. And as we find out later in the text, a part of that is spent on prostitutes. At least his brother accuses him of doing that. So this son is as shameful a son as you could think of in this culture. He has made a disrespectful request. He has treated his share of the estate and his family with scorn and has traveled into Gentile land to waste his life on the lusts of the flesh. This is the example of a very shameful son. And the Pharisees would be standing there just wagging their fingers at this son. This is just unfathomable, unthinkable to them. He ought to be severely punished. Now, moving on into verse 14. Did I answer your question, Loretta? Okay. Let's move on to verses 14 through 16. Now, when he had spent everything, a severe famine occurred in that country, and he began to be impoverished. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, and he sent him into his fields to feed swine. And he would have gladly filled his stomach with the pods that the swine were eating, and no one was giving anything to him. So as we noted last time, something happens that is out of his control. A severe famine occurs. But while this is out of his control, this would really send him spiraling downward very quickly. And one thing that John MacArthur brings out is what a severe famine might look like. I thought this was very instructive. It's also very graphic, so bear with me a little bit. In the Old Testament, there is the example of Israel being under siege. And of course, when you are under siege, you are going to be in a forced famine by the enemy. And so women would eat their afterbirth, and some even cannibalize their children. That is in the history of Israel. So clearly, a famine of extreme nature brings out severe desperation in order to stay alive. And he also shares an account of a famine from the 1800s, so a more recent one. But I think it gives you a very clear picture of what a severe famine could look like and possibly what would be going on in the minds of the hearers. Granted, this is in the 1800s, but I don't think this would be much different. He says this, children were being sold into slavery to keep them from starving. Men were found dead every morning on the streets, and when their numbers increased, the ruler of the city declared every man responsible for throwing the dead bodies in front of his house into the river. However, some, not wanting to have all the dead bodies in front of their house, would drag the dead in front of other people's houses. Yeah. Merchants had to drive off beggars and also throw themselves across their wares to prevent them from stealing. Men venturing out at night unarmed were attacked and eaten. Straying animals were killed and eaten raw. shoe leather, rotten flesh, and garbage were all devoured. Some bricked themselves within their own houses and awaited death so as to prevent being devoured by hyenas. So this is what a severe famine could very well look like.
Did you say that men devoured other men?
Mm-hmm. This is so a case in the 1800s.
Cannibalism.
Mm-hmm.
There have been cases in the United States. Well, the grill at Colorado University was named the Alfred J. Packer Memorial Grill. Alfred J. Packer and four other guys were trapped in the mountains in the wintertime.
Mm.
And as they died, Alfred J. Packer was the last guy to live.
Yep.
When his buddies.
In desperation,
yeah.
People will do that. They just will in order to stay alive. So the hearers would know of instances like this in Israel's history, and this really paints a picture of us, for us, of the level of desperation the younger son is now in. Given that fact, is the son willing to go home yet?
No,
he's not yet. Not quite. In order to do so, he would have to humble himself and face the shame of his actions when he came back. So he does something different. Last time we had talked about, he does something which seems to be kind of wise, kind of prudent. He attaches himself to a citizen. Now, last time I had talked about him hiring himself out to a citizen. And we're going to look at this a little bit more. So, not everyone is a citizen. So this man would have had some means. He would have been kind of up in the social scale. But while the NAS translates the word kolao as hired himself out, the clearer meaning of the word is join together or cleave together, to keep company together or to glue together. So there's really no indication that this younger son has hired himself out to anybody. He has stuck to the citizen. He found the citizen and has clung to him. So with a better understanding of that word, there is also no indication that this is a hired position. And also could be indicative that this was not the idea of the citizens. Now, I don't know if any of you have been to other countries before, but it did bring to mind, Katie and I have been to China before, and there are beggars on the street, and they will follow you for a long time. If you're just walking down the street, they'll follow you, they'll cling to you, particularly children. I think children were the ones that clung to us the most. It is just heartbreaking, but they would just cling to you, they would try to get what they could from you. So you kind of get that this is what the younger son is doing. So in order to just get rid of him, this citizen, he sends him out into the fields to feed the pigs. And as we talked about last time, this would have been absolutely disgusting and also defiling. And we get a picture of a young man at his absolute worst, at the absolute bottom. And to the Pharisees, of course, this work that he's doing is absolutely unthinkable. So while he's out there, he longs for the carob pods that the pigs were eating, something you would not normally want to eat. But again, he is desperate, and desperation can make you do things you would not normally think to do. So no one is giving anything to him. There's no one there to comfort him. He is completely bankrupt in more than one sense of the word. And this is what sin does. It alienates us from God and leads to spiritual bankruptcy. And this is where this younger son is at. Moving on to verses 17 through 19. But when he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired men have more than enough bread, but I am dying here with hunger? I will get up and go to my father and will say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me as one of your hired men.'" As we mentioned last time, this young man eventually comes to his senses. He accurately sees the situation that he is in, that he cannot get out of it, that he is on the brink of death. And as we talked about last time, this is a picture of the beginning of repentance. He is owning up to where he is at right now. He's making no excuses for where he is at right now. It is his own doing that he is in dire need and on the brink of death. He had come to the end of himself. He is the one who rebelled. He is the one who dishonored his father. So having an honest assessment of himself, he also has an honest assessment of his father. He knows him to be a generous and gracious man. He knows how he deals with his day laborers, his hired men. So he comes up with a plan to throw himself at his father's mercy, confesses sins, and requests to be made a hired man or a day laborer. This was his plan to make restitution. Remember, this is what they would have expected. In order for him to come back, he had to make restitution. He had to repay what he has squandered. And to be made less than a slave in his father's household was his plan to do that. He wanted to not be a burden to his father, but he wanted to make restitution. He wanted to repay all that he squandered. He understood that he has no rights any longer because he sold all of them. Now, how do you think the Pharisees would respond to this? This younger son's plan?
Well, they'd have
same way the older brother did.
What's that, Rick?
The same way the older brother did.
How's that?
He was furious, angry.
Okay. They might.
Jealous.
Yeah, they would actually affirm what the younger son's doing. For the first time in the story, this younger son is doing something that makes sense. So they would affirm this. If he is truly repentant, then he will have to face the humiliation and the scorn. He would have to take the punishment he deserves for the rest of his life, or at least the rest of the time it is going to take to repay his father and make restitution. This is the theology of the Pharisees, and really the theology of every other religion of the world besides Christianity, that you have to pay for your way into salvation. You have to do good works, that you have to earn your salvation. And this is exactly what the Pharisees thought, and they would have affirmed what this younger son was deciding to do. So verse 20, so he got up and came to his father, but while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion for him and ran and embraced him and kissed him. So from the beginning of verse 20, we see the immediacy of which the son wants to do this. He has made up in his mind this is what he's going to do, and he gets up immediately and he goes to do this. But in this honor-shame culture, the story takes a ridiculous turn, at least to the scribes and Pharisees, and maybe other hearers among them. Now, what they would expect, I'm going to tell you what they would have expected the father to do when this younger son came. What they would expect the father to do is not even be looking for his son. Not even be looking. Remember, he has brought dishonor, and the father's honor has been tarnished. Not only in his own household, but also in the community because of what this younger son has done. If the son were to come back, the father would not make himself available to receive him, at least for some days. He would refuse to see him. A more extreme example of this is David, who after allowing Absalom to return, he also refused to see his son, but that was for a period of 2 years. Now, granted, that was a slightly different relationship. You had not only a father-son relationship, you also had a king and a son relationship. You also had murder mixed in there. But that is an example of a father refusing to see his son for the dishonor that has been brought upon them. So the purpose behind this was to allow the son to face the ridicule and scorn of the village. This would have been a way for the father to redeem his own honor by shaming his son, by allowing his son to go through that shame. The villagers would mock him, they would slander him, maybe spit on him. The son would have expected this treatment, and he knew he would have to take it. Remember, He has been brought to the absolute bottom and was willing to do what it would take. And this is part of it. He knew that. And this is what would have been expected. And then, after some time had passed, the father would eventually receive him, but they would expect it to be a cold reception, almost business-like, where the son would bow low and kiss the father's feet, and then the father would dictate the terms of how he would repay everything. And then, and only then, once everything has been repaid, the terms of the restitution have been met, then there could be reconciliation. This is what the son deserves. This is what he deserves. But this is not what happens, is it? Instead, something absolutely ridiculous and shameful happens, and this would have caused a shock amongst the hearers. It says, but while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion for him and ran and embraced him and kissed him. This is exactly the exact opposite of what they would have expected the father to do. And as we talked about last time, in order to see him a long way off and to notice he was coming that day, he would have had to continually been looking for his son. So that is countercultural. And because he could see his son a long way off, it would indicate that this is daytime. And because this is daytime, all the villagers are outside. They're all going about their business. It's busy, and there are lots of witnesses around for what's going to happen next. It says that when he saw him, he felt compassion for him. And his compassion was such that he endured shame, even more shame, for his son. As we talked about last time, the father's actions are immediate. He doesn't wait and ponder, oh, what should I do? Should I go back to my house and wait for him to come up to the house? No. He makes up in his mind what he is going to do, and it is immediate. He is the one who initiates. And the first thing he did was he runs. And the word really is he sprints to his son. This was not a culturally acceptable thing to do because you might expose your legs, which was very humiliating for a man of his age. Kenneth Bailey, who I mentioned earlier, he has studied Middle Eastern culture by being a missionary there for many years. And he writes this about running and the garb that the father would be wearing. One of the main reasons why Middle Easterners of rank do not run is that traditionally they all have long robes. This is true of both men and women. No one can run in a long robe without taking it up into his or her hands. And when this occurs, the legs are exposed, which is considered humiliating. Clearly, exposure of the legs was considered shameful. The robes themselves reached to the ground to make sure this didn't happen. Now, this is interesting and somewhat humorous. A quaint ruling for the Sabbath states that if a bird crawls under your robes on the Sabbath, you may not catch it. The suggested alternative is to sit very quietly and wait for sundown so no one can see, and then you can seize the bird. So that's how important it is to not expose your legs. Further, on the Sabbath, you could smooth out your robe to make it look nice, but you couldn't lift it up. If your robe did not reach the ground and you didn't have a longer one for the Sabbath, you had to take the hem out of it so that it touched the ground. Also, no one should jump or take long strides. One foot should be on the ground at all times. The reason for this ruling is to assure that no part of the leg is ever exposed. Outer robes themselves are called, I'm not going to pronounce this right, mekibedith, meaning that which brings me honor. Your honor was connected to the robe. So, and then John MacArthur, he goes on to explain that the idea that the father is running is so offensive that there is an actual unwillingness to say that the father runs in the Arabic versions of the Bible. Instead, they say he hurried, or he hastened, or presented himself. So you don't get the picture of the father running. That is why. That is how shameful this would have been. And so we see not only the immediacy for which the father wants to see his son, but more importantly, we see that the father is bringing shame upon himself in order to protect his son from the shame of walking through the village. The father knew that once he reached the village, the mocking, the shaming, the rebuking would begin, and he wants to spare his son of this. This is a display of love, a self-sacrificing display of love. The father empties himself of any pride, rights, or honor. The father condescends. He bears on himself the shame the son deserves. Does that sound familiar at all?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a picture of the gospel right there.
Dad?
Yes?
Can I ask, is there any kind of indication about how long the son's been gone? Does that matter?
Not really any indication.
Okay.
Just says he spent all of that money. Don't know how long it would take to spend that money, but I would guess for a teenager it wouldn't take very long, but there's really no indication. So the father, he condescends, and as he comes to the son, he embraces him, he falls upon his neck, and he kisses him all over. By the way, what condition is the son in right now?
Pretty stinky.
He is stinky.
Oh, my pig.
The last time we knew, he was wallowing in the pig filth. And this father doesn't care. He embraces him, puts his neck down upon, he puts his head down upon his neck, kisses him all over. So he is really loving on his son in spite of all the filth on him. Has the son done anything to deserve this? No. It's totally. He has. He hasn't even said a word yet, has he? He has come back, but he hasn't said a word.
The father doesn't know if he's coming back looking for more.
Yeah,
no?
Could be. That's true.
Well, the father expects him to come back there. That's kind of the, there's a limit there as far as how you relate it to God, but still, the father knew, seemed to know, the son was coming back. But he knew more about the son.
I don't think he ever knew.
Yeah.
He was looking for him. That's
God,
true.
Though, so God knew, but the father was still there looking.
Okay, I think that might be stretching it a little bit there. But
here's what you have to be careful with parables.
Right.
Yeah. Parables, you take the attributes of the characters to explain something about God. You don't take the character of God to explain something about the character.
Yeah.
Plus, if we actually looked at the father, it would fit perfectly in today's modern method of raising children. Or you just let them do the things they need to do, and they'll be all right in the end. You can't say that.
Well, there have been some that use this parable to talk about parenting. So, the son has not done anything to deserve this. Absolutely nothing. And this is the shock. This is the shock. This is a picture of grace for which the Pharisees did not understand or comprehend. And this action by the father would have been absolutely disgraceful and ridiculous in their sight. Absolutely ridiculous. So moving on, verse 21. And the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven in your sight. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Now, as we had talked about last time, he had made this confession that he had resolved to do. However, he left out one part, and that was the request to be made a hired servant. Now, last time, what I had said was a possibility was that the father interrupts him, so he's not able to say it. Another possibility is, what has he just received?
Forgiveness, basically.
Forgiveness.
More than what he hoped for. What's that?
Forgiveness.
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 Forgiveness. He's just received grace.
Right.
And so to say to the father, make me a hired servant, would be what to that grace?
Just another shame.
It'd be an insult, yeah. It'd be shameful for him to request that. He's just been extended this great measure of grace. And so then to request to work off that grace he just received would have been an insult to the giver of that grace and an insult to the shame his father had just endured for him. So that could be another possibility.
Dad, is there any significance to him saying, I have sinned against heaven?
Yes.
And in your sight? I thought of David in the Psalms where he says, you know, against you and you only have I sinned.
And I didn't bring this out, but the wording here is, he says, I have sinned up to heaven. So he is saying, my sins are great. They reach up to heaven, is what he's saying there. So he really has an honest assessment of how great his sin is, not only to his father, but also there is some that he has sinned against God. So there's definitely both. He recognizes both there. So moving on, verses 22 through 24. But the father said to his slaves, quickly bring out the best robe and put it on him and put a ring on his hand and sandals on his feet and bring the fattened calf, kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and has come to life again. He was lost and has been found. And they began to celebrate. So as if the running and embracing and kissing weren't enough, now the father is heaping blessing upon the son whom he has reconciled. Not just any blessing. We talked last time that the robe would have been the best robe, which most likely belonged to the father. It signifies honor, dignity. And usually this was worn on special occasions and most likely would have been reserved for the older son upon his marriage. So a very, very special robe. You might liken this to a tuxedo or a suit that you bring out when there's a special occasion or a dress. So very, very significant. The ring would have had the family crest or seal. And so this signifies authority to act on the father's behalf. And the sandals were reserved for masters and sons, not hired men or slaves. So this is a picture of complete reconciliation, complete restoration. This is sonship. Full rights, privileges, honor, respect, responsibility, all restored. And this is immediate. The father says, quickly, this is what I want done quickly. There is no waiting period. There is no period where this younger son has to prove himself. Sonship is restored at once. Now, by the way, now that the younger son has the authority to act on his father's behalf, whose future inheritance is he now meddling in? There's only 2/3 of the estate left, and now he's meddling in the older son's estate. So this does not make sense to the Pharisees. Once again, grace does not make sense to legalists. All of this is undeserved, complete restoration without any works. This does not make sense. And then the father calls for a great celebration. He wants the fattened calf, the grain-fed veal, to be butchered, cooked, and eaten. And this would feed about 200 people. So this was going to be a huge celebration. And this would have included inviting people within the community. And this celebration could last for hours. There's no time for them to plan. He wants this to happen immediately. So they've got to take some time to butcher the calf. They've got to take some time to get it cooked. So this is going to be a huge, long celebration. And really, this is a celebration about the father more so than it is the son. Even though the father gives the reason for the celebration, he says, "This son of mine was dead and has come to life again. He was lost and has been found." Now, how could there be a celebration had the father not done what he did? Absolutely not. So this is a celebration all about what the father has done. This is a celebration of the love of the father towards his son. Without that love, without his complete willingness to reconcile, there would be no celebration. It was the Father who gave the Son his life back from the dead. Now notice how the Father responds to what he has done for his Son. This brings him great joy. It is because it brings him joy that he wants to celebrate. Now we'll get into verses 25 and 26, and then I probably have to stop there. And we'll pick it up next time. 25 and 26. Now his older son was in the field, and when he came and approached the house, he heard music and dancing. And he summoned one of the servants and began inquiring what these things could be. Now we had talked about last time how the son was out in the field. He was doing his duty. Because he was the master of the estate, he would likely have just been overseeing the work being done in the field. And what's interesting about this part of the story is that the older son doesn't know anything. He doesn't know anything. Why hasn't the father told him anything? Now, one thing we didn't talk about last time was that one of the duties of the older son was to be the one who plans the celebrations. In particular, those that were supposed to be about the honor of the family. But he hasn't been consulted, has he? Hasn't even been told about this party. So this serves as further evidence that he has no relationship with either his brother or his father. He wasn't there to try and stop his brother from leaving. He wasn't there to mediate the relationship between his brother and father. He is close physically, but not close relationally.
Well, he may well have, the father may well have already known the older son, because I can't imagine him spending all that time and never saying anything, never grumbling, never complaining, anything like that. The father may well have known, but I guess the result's the same.
He could have known. He could have known what's in the older son's heart this whole time, but we'll see an outburst of the older son. So, again, whose future resources are being used here for this celebration?
The older son's.
The older son.
And he spent all this time working to make what he was given profitable, and accumulating even more.
But he also continued to take care of his father, too. His father lived with him.
Yeah. Okay. So you're going to see this in his outburst. So to the Pharisees, this is just a further insult. The father's decisions continue to not make any sense to them, as this is really a waste of resources in their minds. And it's not until this older son, he approaches the house and he hears the music and dancing, so it must have been a fairly large estate because he couldn't hear from out in the field. So if... Here's a good question. If the older brother loved his younger brother and his father, what kinds of actions would you expect from him at this point? He's come up to the house. He hears the music, the singing, and the dancing. If he loved his younger brother, if he loved his father, what would you expect him to do?
He'd jump right into party.
He would have jumped right into party. Yeah, why?
Celebration.
It's a celebration. He would mirror what his father is doing right now. He would find joy in what his father finds joy in. And what his father is finding joy in is the restoration of his younger brother. And he would love to see his younger brother back if he loved his younger brother and if he loved his father. But we don't see that, do we? He summons a servant. Rather, the word used here is a young boy, to find out what is going on.
So would he still have done that if he had a different heart? I mean, was that typical to ask the servant instead of go himself to see what's going on?
No real indication from that I could find. It's possible that that is just customary. But, I mean, he is a master of the estate, so he had every right to just come right in. But as we will see here in a little bit, he refused to go in once he found out what's going on. So this looks like a good place to stop. I will continue from verse 27 and then kind of look at the spiritual implications of this parable and wrap that up. So next Sunday we'll look at that again. And then the following Sunday I'm going to try and get into the parable of the soils. That is one other big parable we have not gotten to yet. So let's pray. Father, as we continue to unpack this parable, looking at it through the eyes of the hearers back in that time, Lord, I thank you for how it has illumined my own eyes, that it really makes this parable explode with further meaning. And so, Father, we thank you that your word is living and active. It continues to teach us, continues to grow us and sanctify us, as it has this morning. Father, as we continue our worship, may it be pleasing to you. May it be a sweet sound in your sight. We love you, and it's in your son's name we pray. Amen.